Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:21 PM, that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is February 14th, so happy Valentine's Day. But I thought today being Friday and being the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes, I would kick off with the long-term log scale chart of the S&P 500. And I've put a 1,000-day moving average on there. That's the equivalent of a 200-week or a 60-month chart. But what I find particularly interesting is that during secular bull markets, it is the most reliable of the long-term trend smoothing devices. And we've got two full examples of secular bull markets, and we're well into a third. There were a number of occasions between approximately 1949 and into 1968 when the market found support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And in that time, the value of the index went from approximately 15 to a peak of around 100. So that was a pretty impressive advance all the way from the post-war period through until about 1969. Then we had a prolonged period of ranging, and during that period of ranging, the usefulness of a 1,000-day moving average was eroded and probably forgotten, and we had some swinging pullbacks in the order of 30% and in the order of 40%. And we can be guaranteed that there were calls at the time that it was the end of the market as we know it. But the market did break on the upside. It started finding support again in the region of the 1,000-day moving average in the late 1970s, and then clearly found support on a number of occasions all the way through the 1990s, became really quite overextended relative to the trend mean from approximately 1995 onwards, and reached a peak in 2000, broke back below the 1,000-day moving average in 2001. Not only did that presage a much deeper decline subsequently, but the onset of another very lengthy ranging phase where the size of the pullbacks was extraordinary, well in excess of 50%, for example, during 2008. And then the market started finding support again in the region of the 1,000-day moving average from approximately 2012 onwards. And it was on seeing the fact that there were so many shares, but particularly those of major companies, particularly those that were leveraged to the growth of the global consumer, those that would benefit most from technological innovation and from the evolution of unconventional oil and gas. That was what prompted David and I to come up with the autonomies designation and to identify approximately 160 companies that were probably going to be the ones that would lead us in terms of big cap growth over the course of this secular bull market. That's why I wrote, there were two reasons I wrote Crowd Money. The first was to teach myself the chart seminar, and that was certainly, and it was to act as a guide to or a textbook for the seminar, but then it was also to highlight the potential from base formation completion. And base formation completion has been one of the most reliable indicators, and continuation patterns that I've seen in the course of my career, at least. Now, if we continue to see the pattern of consistency that we've had over the last 100 years, well, we can anticipate that there are going to be periods when the market goes through these extraordinarily long ranging phases, and there will be occasions during those ranging phases when the market is quite capable of pulling back by 50%. However, during the trending phases, and the trending phases can last really a long time, they can last anything up to 20 years, then that tells us that we're probably only about halfway through. Now, that does not mean that a secular bull market will not be punctuated occasionally by recessions. We, for example, have had some very significant pullbacks over the course of secular bull markets. We had the 1987 crash, which looks like nothing more than a consolidation in the context of a major bull market. We've also had periods where we've had acceleration, and that also in one occasion represented a trend ending, and really at the beginning of the move in the 1950s, it represented the onset of a new bull market following the Depression. What's interesting here is that the loss of momentum and the break in the consistency was the topping characteristic in the late 1960s. It was the acceleration was the topping characteristic in the 1990s. Now, when we perhaps zoom in a little, well, we can see that the market has been doing really spectacularly well, and it is now quite overextended relative to the trend mean. Now, we are occasionally going to have these periods when the market does become widely overextended relative to the trend mean, and then the potential is that we have a significant pullback. Now, every major trend has its own individual consistency characteristics. So we know what the long-term consistency is, that the market is capable of going sideways for prolonged periods of time, and that's when the potential for a crash becomes most acute. During the trending phases, then we're going to have occasional medium-term corrections, and it's particularly interesting over the course of the last decade that we've had three, and the three medium-term corrections we've had have lasted approximately 18 months. And each one of those has subsequently had a consolidation in the region of the previous peaks. So that's an additional consistency characteristic. When that small step in the region of the previous peak is resolved, we get these really quite persistent periods of performance. And that does look like what we're getting right now. So we are somewhat overbought in the short term, and there is the potential that we're going to have some consolidation at some point over the next few weeks. But the much bigger picture here is that it is quite possible that the stock market can go substantially higher from here over the course of the next year. When we look at this longer term chart, and I'm just going to have to turn my keyboard on and off because it's not working. When we look at the arithmetic scale chart and look at that over the course of the last decade, then we can see much more clearly the really persistent periods of outperformance. And we are getting another one of those right now, but it is increasingly overextended relative to the trend mean. When we look at, for example, the gap between the S&P 500 and relative to the 200-day moving average, well, we've got plenty of examples when it becomes really very overextended and stays that way. And we're somewhat overextended right now. So we're coming up to a period here where we're about 28% overextended relative to the trend mean. There have been major peaks, particularly back in 1999 and again in 1987, when the stock market gets really extraordinarily overextended relative to the trend mean, and those have been important peak values. So It is overextended right now, but it could potentially become even more overextended. I think that's the real takeaway here. Now, the important point is that not only do we have this consistency in terms of the lengthier trends, but then these reactions that we've had so far are reasonably similar sized. They're in the order of approximately 130, 140 points. And because we have the succession of higher reaction lows, then those would at least need to be broken in order to really suggest that we are back in a supply-dominated environment. So I think this is a rather important point. One thing that we know, and it is it fits very clearly into the definition of behavioral technical analysis, is that we should anticipate that a big imbalance between supply and demand will create a consistent trend, and that the longer the trend persists for, the more consistent it should become, because it is successfully encouraging more and more investors into the market. It's creating an even wider imbalance between supply and demand, then that clearly helps to smooth out the path of the trend. Now, there are obviously factors that influence every major bull market, and there is a narrative that really does help to get people involved and to encourage them to participate. There are a number of narratives in the market today. The first is that we are moving progressively into a digital economy. So, with the continued performance of the cloud sector, and that is dominated now by the largest companies in the world, then this remains a high-growth sector. It's also benefiting from the fact that because of its prevalence and the clear evidence that they can provide productivity growth for companies that adopt cloud infrastructure, well, then the competition is that if you don't adopt the kinds of solutions that are on offer, your company is probably going to underperform. It's a labor-saving device, and therefore it's going to become invaluable to all economies and all companies over the course of the next few years. Now, of course, this is not a new story. The cloud sector has been a major focus of attention following the base formation completions back in 2013. The original play in the sector was Salesforce, and it has recently just completed its own lengthy consolidation and now is looking quite overextended. But considering the fact that it went sideways for a year and a half, then ranges are explosions waiting to happen, and this has been a really impressive breakout. I don't think that it is the best use of one's time to become overly concerned about ranges that have broken out in a dynamic manner. That's a very clear bullish characteristic, provided those breakouts hold. What I think is more important is to watch the kinds of accelerations that we're getting in other shares. So, for example, Microsoft has rallied incredibly spectacularly over the course of the last year, and it has been going up in a very persistent manner now for most of the last 7 years, following the breakout in 2013. So now we have clear evidence of acceleration, and this is equally true of Apple. And Apple did pull back for 1 week and then improved upon that performance in here this week. We can also see that the share has been subject to some really very lengthy periods of consolidation, and during the pullbacks, it is quite capable of pulling back by anything from 40 to 50%. The most rivetingly consistent point in terms of Apple's trend over the course of the last decade is that each one of the consolidations is above the last, and therefore the primary consistency characteristic is that when it eventually does decide to start coming back, then the upper side of the underlying range should represent an area of support, and by the time it gets there, it will probably coincide with the 1,000-day moving average. The prevalence of the cloud and the evolution of the software as a service business model, which is very much twinned with the subscription business model, is something that is smoothening out cash flows. It's also turning what would have historically been considered to be highly cyclical businesses into the kinds of predictable cash flow businesses that one would associate with utilities or consumer staples, except that they have the same margins as technology companies. That's an additional characteristic of the best performing companies. Whether one is looking at Apple and the ecosystem that it has evolved around the App Store, whether it is Microsoft with the evolution of its business model into a 365 service rather than selling new iterations of its software every couple of years. It's exactly the same with the evolution of Amazon's Prime network, and that share has also broken out of a lengthy range in here. And again, it's another example of a company that is quite capable of going sideways for lengthy periods of time, but that each of the ranges tends to be above the last, and it has a history of pausing in the region of big psychological numbers. So it paused at 1,000, it found support around 1,300, it paused at 2,000, paused at 400, paused at 250, and it paused at $100. So these are clear evidence of investors taking profits when they get to these big round numbers. But the big point here, of course, is that each of the ranges has been above another, and it has just broken on the upside. So this is now becoming a very easy trend to monitor, because it would need to fail. And the most important thing that it has never done in the course of a decade-long bull market has been to fail to sustain the upward break. And that's, I think, one of the most important points. That would be a very clear indication that we're getting some supply dominance, is if Amazon fails to sustain a move above one of these big psychological number levels. So that's one narrative, that we have the evolution of the data-centric and digital economy, and the evolution of the cloud sector, and the fact that companies simply cannot do without these services. It has also greatly depressed the cost of setting up a new business, and there are companies today that have been able to prosper because they haven't had to build the infrastructure themselves. They've been able to outsource the back end of whatever idea it is that they've come up with to companies like Amazon or Microsoft or Google. And what that has done has been to very clearly help to benefit the larger cap companies. Not only are they doing well in their own right, but what they are also doing is facilitating growth in the rest of the economy. And Google has also now broken up and out of the most recent one of its ranges. Now, obviously, that's the bullish narrative. Now, there is obviously in any bullish narrative going to be the countervailing argument. The countervailing argument in terms of the assistance that the cloud sector has given to the startup sector is in terms of now their reliance. It's almost a perfect example of the master-slave dialectic. So these masterful companies are now reliant on the smaller companies, despite the fact that the smaller companies are loss-making. But that's not a consideration in the short term. When those loss-making companies that are padding the earnings of the large companies eventually go bust, and there is no doubt that some of them will go bust, well, then that is going to rob the larger companies of a significant source of revenue. And then we will see a deeper pullback. But because we're in a very low interest rate environment, and because there is still abundant liquidity, then that is forestalling the eventual problem that a large number of loss-making companies are going to have. That brings us to the additional narrative. When we think about the government bond markets, unfunded liabilities are very significant, and they're not going to go away. The quantity of money that has been promised to government employees in the form of pensions and healthcare benefits, the same kinds of promises that have been made to retirees, these are going to be extraordinarily expensive to fulfill, and it pretty much ensures that governments are inhibited from raising interest rates. Or I should say central banks are inhibited from raising interest rates because the governments are so heavily indebted. So that is keeping a lid on interest rate rises. But the problem with any trend that persists for a lengthy period of time is that it changes the fundamentals. Because we've had this incredible period where we've had low interest rates persist for a lengthy period of time, where we've had governments running record deficits and central banks increase the size of their balance sheets to previously unimaginable levels without deleterious consequences, then that changes the perception of risk. And it is very similar to what we have with Wile E. Coyote, that he runs and runs and then runs off the edge of the cliff and doesn't know that there's nothing underneath him until he puts a toe down. Well, it's quite similar to what we're seeing with the trajectory of sentiment now towards the acceptance of modern monetary theory. The reality is that we kind of have it already, and it has always been a peripheral factor in terms of the US economy in particular, because the US presidential cycle has been in evidence for at least the last 60 years. And the first year of the cycle is characterized by central banks raising interest rates and the political parties introducing the most unpopular of their election promises, because they have 4 years to get over it. It's therefore usually the worst performer in terms of the stock market over the four-year cycle. By the time we get around to the second year, the corrective measures that were taken in the first year are starting to bear fruit and growth starts to pick up. So the second year is usually better than the first year. You usually get a growth scare in the middle of the third year, and that is usually because the central bank has been raising interest rates. They have been trying to inhibit the inflationary pressures or the excesses that had built up following the corrective phase in the first year and the recovery in the second year. That generally has a growth scare, and they have to start cutting interest rates again. There's a lagged effect on those interest rate cuts, so they start showing up again in the second half of the third year. And it's usually we get a strong rally in the second half of the third year, and the fourth year is generally speaking the best performer in terms of stock market performance. And the central bank will not cut interest, or will not, excuse me, raise interest rates in an election year without very considerable cause, because of the incumbent benefits. They generally tend to look after whoever is the incumbent. So that is the outline of the US presidential cycle. And now let's just think about the last year and a half. We had a period of synchronized global economic expansion all the way through until the end of 2017 and the beginning of 2018. We had a period then of uncertainty, and we had a significant pullback in the second half of 2018 because of the uncertainty about what the trajectory of central bank policy was going to be. That growth scare really went into overdrive at the end of 2018, and the central bank started cutting interest rates. Well, we had a very significant rebound in terms of appetite for risk at the beginning of 2019, and yields compressed by 50% all the way through 2019. There was a clear signal sent to the market that there was no way they were going to continue to raise interest rates, and they were going to cut interest rates instead. And we're now in the fourth year, so we've had the growth scare, and the economy is still very steady, and it is extraordinarily unlikely that the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates in 2020. In fact, with the interest rate where it is right now, where the 10-year yield is at 1.58%, the stock market and the bond markets are pretty much already pricing in that there's going to be additional rate cuts this year. And that is all aimed at supporting the incumbent. Well, that's just simply the normal course of events, where there is a very tacit and unspoken support mechanism for the political establishment coming from the Federal Reserve. What we saw an example of during the repo crisis back in September of 2019 was a much more formal relationship between the central bank and the willingness of the government to run extraordinary deficits. Because the US Treasury had been siphoning money out of the repo market to fund its deficits, we got to a situation where there was a shortage of liquidity. The Federal Reserve subsequently added in an additional $400 billion. So that has been a significant factor. It greatly increased the size of the Fed's balance sheet. It unwound the vast majority of the previous quantitative tightening. We did have some news yesterday that the amount of assistance that the Federal Reserve is willing to supply to the repo market is going to be tapered again this month, and it will be tapered again next month. So they are trying to inhibit the continued expansion of the balance sheet, but it was at a new recovery high on Wednesday. So there is still a benign environment in terms of economic conditions. Now, when we look at a financial conditions, hold on, I seem to talk and chew gum. If we look at, for example, Goldman's financial conditions index, then this is the opposite of the Federal Reserve's one. It is almost now at a financial easiness almost on par with what we saw at the end of 2017. So we still have extremely liquid markets and a lot of financial conditions that are very easy, and that is helping to support the market. When people look at the continued strength of the S&P 500 against a background where China's economy has pretty much come to a standstill, then those financial conditions continuing to remain easy are a very significant factor. Then I think there is also the anomaly we're having here right now, where the euro has been falling now for 10 of the 11th of the last 11 consecutive days. This is a rather interesting situation. It would be very easy to conclude that it's happening because of Europe's reliance on Chinese imports. But if that were the case, it wouldn't just be the euro declining. It would be European stock markets. It would be everywhere else as well. And it's just not happening. Instead, it's quite likely that this extraordinary decline in the euro, where it has gone from 111 and change down to 108 in the space of just 2 weeks and reasserted the trend on the downside in very emphatic fashion. Well, what this is clearly saying is something else is going on, and it is quite likely it's a carry trade. The last time we've had the kind of carry trades that are going on today in the euro was back with the yen in really the beginning of the decade. So, of the last decade, I should say. Europe has got negative deposit rates. It's got very close to zero interest rates. And the temptation, therefore, is to borrow the currency and to invest it elsewhere. And that works as long as the euro is going down. And that is one of the primary, I think, tailwinds behind asset prices right now. It's particularly beneficial to the USA because the dollar index has been the other side of that trade, and it has been surging over the course of the last 2 weeks. But when we look at the total assets of central banks, then that figure has contracted by about 100 billion over the course of the last week for the simple reason that the euro has been so weak, and in currency adjusted terms, it has contracted because of that weak euro. The total assets of central banks is, I think, an important measure of global liquidity. But because the strength of the dollar is such an important factor, it is greatly enhancing the allure of Wall Street relative to other markets. I think it's also worth highlighting this ratio. I looked at this about a month ago, and I thought it would be relevant to highlight it again today. It is the performance of value relative to growth. Now, there was some speculation at the end of last year that value was had fallen enough and that it was going to start outperforming growth. Well, that was clearly wrong, and it has massively accelerated on the downside. The outperformance of growth versus value has been incredibly profound. Now, this is obviously going to raise a lot of questions for people. How can this be possible? How can you have the largest companies in the world almost doubling in the space of a year and this growth phenomenon persisting almost indefinitely? Because it has been underway for a decade, and logically, somebody could conclude that eventually value stocks are going to have their day. But the much bigger question is not so much about when that might happen, but why it's happening on the one hand, and what exactly is value at this stage in the cycle? Because the pace of technological innovation is such that it is destroying the notion of value. When we look at a company, for example, like Ford, on a value perspective, a company like Ford is trading at a very low PE. It's trading at a high dividend yield, but the share price has done nothing but fall for years now. And it's still a consistent downtrend, and it is still potentially going to move lower from here. And it has got the clear characteristic of a company that could easily be downgraded into junk. One of the biggest factors that is limiting the ability of value to attract interest has been the profusion of liquidity. Then there has been the competition. I think there is a very close parallel today between value and a number of the gold miners in the last cycle. Gold miners historically were viewed as companies that could offer leverage to the gold price. And then we had the evolution of ETFs. So they tended to not get the same kind of support from investors. And when they started borrowing money to expand into new mines, which were inherently uncertain ventures, they started to underperform in a very dynamic manner. And investors didn't have to own those shares because they had the alternative, which in that case was ETFs. Well, let's think about value shares today, because the most successful value investors, where they have been able to generate really impressive returns over the last decade, have been in the private equity sector. Now, I think most classic value investors would think that that comparison is an insult to their discipline. But the reality is that if you can identify a company that is innovating and starting to generate revenues and is at whatever about being cash flow positive, but is generating revenues, then the investment rationale becomes rather compelling. And why then be invested in the companies that are being disrupted? Because unfortunately, a large number of the companies that fit into the value metric are those that are being disrupted. One of the reasons why Ford has been underperforming is because it is heavily reliant on its finance arm against a background where auto delinquencies are nearly back at the peak posted in, I think it was 2013. So if we look at, for example, at that chart, then we get, I think, some interesting information. But the big picture here is that they are going through a $12 billion, let's just call it reclassification, and they are going to have to then produce cars that people in fact want to drive. Against a background where they are praying they can get to that milestone before the tide of delinquent loans overwhelms a number of the automotive companies. So there is the clear potential that Ford represents the kind of company that is not just going to get downgraded, it could potentially go bust. Then we have to think about, for example, Kraft Heinz. This is a company that's probably going to be a case study for intangible value in products for the foreseeable future. This is still a company that is throwing off cash flow in the order of $2.8 billion a year, and yet the share price continues to decline because of the perceived risk in the company. Well, eventually we're going to get to a point where it will represent value, but it's going to have to also start to move with the times and deal with the fact that its products are completely unfashionable. Then when we think about, for example, Marriott, this is a company where they have borrowed extraordinary amounts of money to prevail in the global tourist market, and now they're being assailed by the coronavirus. Now, this company is still trending higher. At least it is above its trend mean. It is doing substantially better than, for example, either Ford or Kraft Heinz. And of course, Kraft Heinz today was downgraded into junk status. Now, this is the countervailing argument to the secular bull market hypothesis, is that a secular bull market papers over a lot of cracks. And the challenge from an investor's perspective is to own the shares that are doing well and to avoid those that are likely to decline. One thing that has been very clear over, since the beginning of this year, has been the underperformance of the energy sector and the outperformance of renewable energy. It is also worth remembering that when we have secular bull markets in equities are generally do tend to coincide with secular bear markets in energy. So we had a profound bull market in energy between approximately 1998 and the peak in 2008. During that time, the stock market went sideways for a very long time. In 2009, when oil prices had started to come down, the stock market started to go up. So there is a little bit of a lag between the lows, between the start of one bull market and the end of the last. But as long as energy prices are going sideways, it is very clear confirmation that we are back in a secular bull market for equities and a secular bear market for energy. The one thing that characterizes secular bear markets in energy is that you get a step change in the marginal cost of production. That's the thing that is very clear in this more than century-long history of oil. That there are plenty of occasions where we have very impressive bull markets, but subsequently the price tends to go sideways for long periods of time, and oil as a concern for investors tends to drop off the mark. Well, today we have the oil sector, which is oversupplied. So that's certainly a significant factor. There is plenty of oil that is economic around the $60 area. There is even more oil, substantially more, that is economic around $100. When, for example, we look at the performance of some of the offshore drillers, I think then we get a very clear message about where is the most expensive of the potential sources of energy. And the really almost terminal declines we're seeing in offshore is a clear indication that they are in a sector of the market which is being priced out. There is a substantial risk that a number of the offshore sources of oil are going to get shut in by the secular bear market. Then we have the fact that unconventional oil and gas really kicked off with shale gas. And shale gas prices in Texas right now are in fact below zero. So they are literally paying people to take gas. Now, that tells us that we are already in an extremely oversupplied situation, and these kinds of conditions do not last indefinitely. So I think it's unlikely we're going to see natural gas prices continuing to fall over the course of the next few months. But the much bigger point is that we are at a position right now where it is more than likely that natural gas prices are going to be ranging for potentially the next decade. And that means that there are going to be massive trough to peak swings. To get back to the peaks where the price was trading at the beginning of 2019 or the end of 2018, the price could nearly triple. So we're going to have very large trough to peak swings, but it's unlikely that we're going to have really impressive bull markets. It's also likely that a lot of coal is going to get locked in because of the cost of producing it, not so much in terms of the physical cost of extraction, but in terms of the regulatory costs. Against this background, the evolution of the renewable sector has really got a shot in the arm. So the solar sector has now broken out to new recovery highs. Then the wind ETF has also broken out to new highs and has in fact completed a 6-year base formation. When we look at lithium miners and the battery sector, it has also broken a downtrend and is back on a clear recovery trajectory. When we look at some of the hydrogen producers, well, we have a situation where the sector is too small to have an ETF just yet. I think it's inevitable that we're going to get that, but we've had a profound advance in a number of the hydrogen producers. So ITM Power in particular is up 200% almost since at the end of November. The very fact that these renewable energy sectors are varied and also doing, they're not just doing better, but and it isn't simply wind or solar or hydrogen, or in this case, geothermal. It's also the renewable infrastructure. So, generally speaking, it has the way of valuing renewable energy over most of the last decade has been to pin it to oil because it was so heavily dependent on a high oil price to justify the investment. But that is just no longer the case. In fact, what is happening in terms of people's perceptions is that it is no longer a choice. It's a necessity that we have renewable energy infrastructure. It isn't as if in the last 3 months there has been a massive breakthrough in terms of technology. There hasn't been. Rather, it's been a change of perception. Certainly, the pace of technological innovation is enhancing the competitiveness of renewable sources, but there has been a step change in terms of market perceptions about why we need to look at renewables. When we think about the floods and droughts and fires in the USA, the fires in Australia, the droughts in Europe, the fires in Europe, the lowest levels on the Elbe in Germany over the summer ever seen, the fact that French wine producers are talking about having to change decades-long methods of harvesting because the grapes are essentially being burned by the high temperatures, the greater intensity of rainstorms because of the somewhat warmer conditions in the atmosphere. All of these conditions and the confluence of these news reports, the intensity of the way that the the news is being reported is contributing to a demand by investors that they want to see an environmental, a social, and a governance perspective. Now, this is obviously a fashionable trend, and it is certainly helping to support these markets. I don't believe we've yet seen the clear conclusion that the answer to the profitability question has been readily come up with, but for the moment we're going to continue to see investment into this sector. One of the ways it's going to be paid for is they're going to tax the conventional producers pretty much into oblivion. And some of the bigger producers, like Royal Dutch Shell, have been pulling back in a rather dynamic manner over the course of the last few weeks in particular. This is taking a significant toll on the companies, and the low price of the commodities they sell is having an additional issue. Royal Dutch Shell currently yields 7.6%. The big question investors are going to be asking is about the sustainability of the dividend. And if it can continue to be sustained, then 7.6% is a really quite impressive return. If the dividend is not present, then the rationale for continuing to support the share is much less convincing. The decline that we've seen over the last 6 years in ExxonMobil is even more exaggerated, but it is now really quite overextended as it tests the lows from all the way back in 2010 and 2008. Here also, though, the sustainability of the dividend is going to be by far the most, I think, concerning aspect for investors. When we think about the fact that we have a secular bear market in energy, it's not simply because of new supply, it's because of competition. It's the competitive forces that are creating so much disruption in terms of the stock market and its performance, but also in terms of perceptions and the rise of populism. There is no doubt that the rise of interest in renewable energy is as much a populist phenomenon as we see in other parts of the political sphere. And the rise of populism and the desire of people who want to support renewables, it also shares a similarity with the nationalism and xenophobia, because the focus of renewables is independence, and the focus of renewables is also in terms of a clean environment. But one of the abiding characteristics of the movement is to ensure that people have national sovereignty over their energy policy, and I do believe that that is a very important characteristic. One of the biggest game changers of unconventional oil and gas has been the complete change of perspective that the USA has adopted, and it has been I think it has changed the way the economy has functioned, so that the oil price is no longer an inhibiting factor to growth for the whole economy. Of course, there are going to be different portions of the economy benefit, but the net-net effect is that it has pretty much excised energy from the consideration of economic growth. I think against all of that background, then we spent some time talking about the different kinds of narratives, that gold is something that does need to be considered in that vein. And I think the most important point is it's completed its base formation. Now, when we look at gold over that long term, on that long term perspective, And also, in terms of the consistency of its trend. And then let's also ensure that we're comparing apples to apples and that this is a 1,000-day moving average, which would be 60 months. And then we'll see what kind of consistency we get in terms of the overall trend. So certainly we can see that there are lengthy periods of time when the gold price does nothing at all. And when gold then does rally, it can rally in a very spectacular fashion. I think the big question that the vast majority of potential gold investors are asking is whether we are in a generational long period of ranging, where there will be impressive peak to trough swings, or whether we're in a new secular bull market. Now, it is worth considering that gold and oil do tend to do well together, and there is a massive divergence now in terms of the performance of gold relative to oil. The 1,000-day moving average is not especially useful in gold, whereas it seems to be very useful in the stock market. The most important thing about gold is that it's a monetary metal, and therefore it is a store of value over the long term. This has been true both before and potentially after the oil age, and I think that is something that is now being reflected in the market. Gold has an intrinsic value because of limited supply and because it has got the historic role of acting as a barometer against which other assets are measured. That is not true of oil. So, gold is doing better today for one simple reason. We know what the response of central banks is to the massive quantities of debt that have been created. It is simple enough. They are either going to devalue their currencies to erode the value of the debt, or they're going to default. Now, there are probably going to be alternatives, but the end result will be the same. So, for example, China is very actively pursuing a digital currency so that they can have control over the issuance of currency. The Federal Reserve and the Bank of England are examining the same alternatives. The evolution of Bitcoin and the alternatives to the alternative currencies are also I think, a clear challenge to the value and persistence of the primary currencies. In other words, private currencies are currencies that are not owned or controlled by anyone else. Competing with national currencies is likely to be a significant factor over the course of the next decade. The fact that Bitcoin is now trading back above 10,000 is certainly something that I think people need to pay attention to. It is also helping to drive interest in the alternative coins. So, for example, Ethereum has popped on the upside in here this week, and since the beginning of this year, it is up from 128 to 287, so it has more than doubled. IOTA is still trading below 50 cents, but it has also moved really quite impressively. And particularly with Ethereum and IOTA, there are some major enhancements to their network expected over the course of this year. Whereas with Bitcoin, there is a halving probably going to happen in, I think it's March at this stage. So that is going to further highlight the limited supply arguments. When we look at oil and gold, I'm just trying to keep an eye out for the the oil gold ratio. And we can, I think, now start to really have some conception of how much of a bear market the energy sector is, but that gold is not necessarily linked to it. That's, I think, one of the biggest changes that we've had. Now, we can think about what is likely in terms of the global market. The fact that the dollar remains very firm is, I think, one of the inhibiting factors to the performance of the global market overall. It's also worth considering that there is the clear potential that we're in a situation that's quite similar to what we had in the mid-1990s. We had the Asian financial crisis in 97 and the Russian debt default in 98, and that resulted in the bankruptcy of long-term capital management. Those shocks, one after another, ensured that interest rates stayed lower for longer, and that allowed a bubble to evolve. I think it's likely that's what's happening today. We have the coronavirus in China, and the containment of that disease is going to represent a significant cost to the Chinese economy. So they are doing their utmost right now to support the currency. I think that if we're thinking about what a rationale might be for some consolidation on Wall Street, then this could quite easily be it. But it is also something that is going to ensure that liquidity stays more abundant than it might all otherwise have been. And China, in particular, is going to have to embark on a massive stimulus to try and correct the damage that's been done to investor sentiment. The shopping districts of just about every city in the region, not just in China, but Taiwan and Korea and Japan, are deserted, and the kinds of controls and quarantines that have been introduced in Singapore are some of the most onerous anywhere. This is something that is going to have a really quite significant impact on consumer sentiment in Asia, and it is going to require a massive stimulus. And that is something that is probably going to help to support asset prices everywhere. What that means is that emerging markets certainly have the potential to play catch up, but that Wall Street is the market that we need to pay most attention to because it is the clear leader, and it is likely to lead on the upside and quite likely to lead on the downside. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.